Good morning. This is the, actually it's 8:03 to be precise. This is Brian Standing, and the show is the Monday 8 o'clock buzz. Got a great show lined up for you today. We'll be speaking with Attorney Mitch on the tenants' rights bill. We'll be talking to him a little bit later in the show. We've got the rant of the week. Our own David Kent Watson brings his perspective on the Star Trek franchise. We'll get a recap on the WRT block party, and yes, the Gagebic Taconite Mining Company applied for a permit for exploratory drilling up in the Pinoki Hills, and then 5 days later withdrew it. So we'll speak to the Ann Coakley from the DNR. She's the mining coordinator over there, and we'll try and get an update as to what exactly is going on up on those Lake Superior shores. All that's coming up right here on the 8 o'clock buzz. Well, regular listeners, including folks who've listened to the Tuesday 8 o'clock buzz, have no doubt heard about Assembly Bill 183. This is state legislation that would overturn tenants' rights ordinances in several Wisconsin cities, including Madison and Fitchburg. The bill would also roll back dozens of hard-won protections for tenants, making it easier for landlords to evict tenants, to charge them for pest control, and to seize renters' property. The legislation continues to roll through the legislature at a speedy pace. The bill is now scheduled for a final vote in the assembly floor on June 4th. Joining us now to give us an update and an analysis is Assistant Clinical Professor of the University of Wisconsin's Neighborhood Law Project, Attorney Mitch. Yes, that is his full name. Mitch, welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thanks, Ryan.
So summarize us for us, please, exactly what AB 183 would do.
Wow. Well, it's a little difficult because there's about 23 different provisions of rights that are largely going away. But to summarize them all in a brief time, I could say that this bill is bad for landlords and really terrible for tenants. I should note right here at the beginning that in addition to being a professor that practices in this area, that teaches this area of law, I'm also a landlord. So I see it from tenants' perspectives, but I also live it from an individual landlord's perspective.
So, I mean, knowing what we know about the, you know, makeup of the legislature, obviously, you know, that there's been a lot of documentation of, you know, money that's been received from landlord groups and realty companies, things like that. You would expect that this bill would favor landlords, and yet you're saying that it's bad for landlords. Why is that? How is that?
Right. It is bad for landlords. This is actually follow-on legislation. In its introduction, it noted that it was introduced to help clean up legislation that was introduced and passed just last year and just took effect in April of 2012. That bill was rushed through there to further take away a lot of different tenants' rights and actually hurt landlords. You had one of the biggest landlord blogs in the state coming out and actually saying, "I'm calling Governor Walker, telling him to veto this bill." That was last year's attempt which was passed. 2011 Act 143, it passed and took effect on April 1st of 2012. That took away rights, and this is here to clean up that notion, that a lot of different priorities here. But again, it's been rushed through, or is being rushed through, and it has not, the drafters of the bill have not consulted any tenants, any tenant advocates, there's been no real deliberative process here. The testimony was at the hearing that they interviewed, about four or five different landlords and attorneys for landlords in drafting this bill. So you'd think that they'd have seen it all and they'd have come up with stuff to protect landlords. But what they haven't seen is what the unintended consequences of the bill are, what the real world consequences will be, things that will hurt landlords. When they pull out rights like this, like they're doing here, 23 different rights, what they're doing to landlords is they're really taking away sort of an owner's manual. That's what the statutes and the codes are for smaller property owners, medium-sized property owners, large property owners who have property managers working for them. This actually, you can go to the statutes. They're a little hard to read, sure. You know, they're two columns in fine print, but you can work your way through them. You can figure out, oh, this is what I need to do, and if I do this, I'm in compliance with the law. Under this bill, and the bill that passed last year, there's no more guidance. A really good example, one of the things that they did last year and they're trying to once again clean up and redo, is it used to be the law in the state of Wisconsin that if you left property behind when you left your tenancy, when you moved out, the landlord had to store it for 30 days at a minimum and give you notice in the mail. If you didn't respond, they give you another notice and put it up for auction. And the landlord could then deduct any charges that they incurred from the sale there, and would have to donate any profit to the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, basically, for the state. Now, so that used to take up about a page and a half in the statutes. Here's what you need to do. Here's the type of notice. Here's all these steps. Now, one might say that that's a lot of regulation, but if you did those few things, you were pretty well insulated as a landlord from a lawsuit from a guy like me. But now, it just simply says if a tenant removes and leaves any property behind, the landlord can do whatever they want with it, and they can sell it for a profit. So if you leave your car because you're driving a U-Haul and you come to pick it up the next day, your lease ends at, say, noon or 5 p.m., you come to pick up your car, which is in the apartment parking lot, the next day, the landlord can, under this bill, sell it. There's no guidance to say, no, don't do that. As a matter of fact, it allows that. Now, that's unlikely to happen in a lot of situations, but that's the type of thing that this allows that sloppy property managers might engage in. To give you a more real-world example, in that case, I was giving a presentation to a bunch of landlords and property managers, and they said, you know, so we went under this new bill that passed last year, and we threw out the stuff that was left behind, because normally it's always trash. Well, if you remember back to moving out of your college apartment, perhaps, a lot of people don't have boxes. They move in trash bags. Hmm. And this property manager, a larger property manager, told me that they threw out these, what they thought were just five or six trash bags. Turns out it was the person's moving bags. Hmm. They have five or six bags left that had their person's laptop, right? The person's dissertation, all of the person's individual photos, irrecoverable things, dumpster, you know, landfill, gone. They're getting sued over this, right? They're getting sued. This is hurting landlords because it took away some real reasonable protections. You store that for a few days, you give notice, you'd be protected, right? The tenant would come back and get what they want and tell you shorter than the 30 days notice that was or time frame that was required. No, go ahead, throw out the rest. Right before there was a way to work it out. And here they're saying, oh, let's just pull all that away, throw it away. And that's exactly what's happened. And it hurts landlords and tenants.
Of course, they're simultaneously looking at doing tort reform and limiting people's ability to sue people for all variety of things. So maybe they're banking on that as basically giving people carte blanche. Do you think that's is that inaccurate?
It is funny that the purported author of the bill has said in the floor debate here that the people, if they're not happy with this, they can just access the courts and sue. Okay, so here you have the Republican author of this bill telling everyone, essentially, you know what? Go ahead and sue your landlord. That's what we're suggesting here. Sue your landlord. In particular, this bill, as drafted, would allow landlords to evict victims of crime. So if your house is broken into, you can be evicted for that.
Because it's obviously your fault.
Yeah. It's stunning. I mean, again, it's rushed through by landlords who what they want is to keep their property safe. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all. But the language that they've done here and not consulting anyone who might be a tenant advocate, who might see the difficult sides that tenants face and who might think creatively about putting together better legislation, that wasn't done. There was no consulting there. And so instead, what you've got is a bill that says go ahead and evict anyone. And what will unfortunately happen, as we've seen with laws against crime, right, which are neutral on their face, but result in incredibly disparate incarceration rates for minority groups, what we will see is, I'm terrified to think of this, but I really believe that we will see more discrimination in housing. And that comment got the author of the bill to say, well, you know, that's not going to be the case. You can, if you're being discriminated against, you just go to court and you just fight this. You just sue your landlord. And I think that's what will happen. You know, you will see more lawsuits out of this.
So what is the rush for all this? I mean, when the sponsors talk about moving this through quickly, I mean, and do they have any rationale for why they haven't consulted with tenant groups or why it needs to be passed in such a speedy manner or why they messed it up the first time and are back again a year later to try and fix it? Is there any public acknowledgement of that?
No, there really isn't, which is, you know, to me, there are two things, two different categories of things. First, there are the 23 provisions which hurt landlords and tenants. And the other thing that this is that's bad about this bill is that I think it's a real failure of leadership. The Republicans control all three, the executive branch in both houses. They could really force compromise. A deliberative process, and they've ignored that chance. They ignored it last year, to their own, they've suffered the consequences of that, and are back again, trying to do this again, but unfortunately not learning from that mistake, to create a bill that would get at least more buy-in from perhaps people in the middle on the political spectrum. So I really think that this is an awful failure of political leadership. Again, there was a really interesting testimony that is 45 tenants to every one landlord. That's testimony at the hearing. So it's also incredibly undemocratic to look away from 45 of your constituents and say, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to vote in favor of this one individual without even considering the input and the value that those other 45 constituents of mine, those other 45 to one renters to landlords, that they could add to this discussion.
So who is supporting this bill? Who is behind it?
Well, I believe you can go online and look at who's registered in favor of it. I believe those are the larger groups, I think, are apartment associations, the Realtors Association. Those are the two that I know that I saw testify. I believe there's some other groups that are registered there in favor of it, despite the fact that I believe that some of their members have some qualms about various different provisions in here that even they think, at least in private conversations have mentioned, I think some of this has been rushed through again. Again, it's just shocking to me that they would, that the legislators, the people drafting this, don't have any concern for deliberation. And when one testifies at a hearing, they simply look over your head at the clock to make sure that your 2 minutes are just about over.
So have any of these larger groups, you mentioned the apartment organizations, the Realtors Association, have they addressed any of the concerns that you've brought up from a landlord's perspective? Are they looking at amendments to this that would sort of ameliorate some of that and put them less on the legal hook? Or do they just dismiss those concerns entirely?
You know, it's hard to say because there's absolutely no dialogue. You get your 2 minutes, and then that is all there is. I watched the floor debate, and it was people talking past one another. And that, again, it's very tragic that there's no engagement here when this affects, you know, this, this maybe isn't the best analogy to sort of say that, you know, when Act 10 passed and you had all of these effect on collective bargaining and union members, you have very few union members, 9-10%. Tenants? That's a much higher percentage of people in the state of Wisconsin. This is going to affect thousands and tens of thousands of more people. And there's no engagement. Once again, it's a sad pattern here. When I've suggested various different things and other advocates have as well, what happens as opposed to engagement is a quick Band-Aid, a quick rewrite, a quick amendment. For instance, last year they created this language that would have allowed victims to be evicted. Victims of crime to be evicted. And that got a lot of people very upset, and a lot of people spoke against it. And then they put in language which they're upset about, which they're trying to clean up now. The response is this knee-jerk, oh, we'll try to fix that on our own. We won't actually engage.
So there were a flurry of amendments made to this bill in committee last week. There are counted at least 9 or 10 different amendments that were proposed, and some of them were tabled and some of them were voted on last week before the final vote was scheduled. What kinds of amendments were we looking at there? What were these trying to deal with?
Well, so specifically the amendments, I believe all but one of them or all but two of them were attempts by the Democrats to make it a little bit more reasonable, and all of them were voted down on a party line. Okay. Again, it was just purely people talking past one another. And then the one amendment that was passed makes evictions is going to be hard on the court system. I don't believe anyone from the court was consulted. It requires jury trials within 30 days to be completed, which is fascinating. I don't think that's going to be actually possible, but also is directly to this issue of evicting victims of crimes. So they had an amendment that tried to address that, but again, the language is not very good and will still allow most victims of crimes to be evicted.
So the other aspect of this bill that we haven't really touched on yet is it seems to follow a trend of recent legislation in the Wisconsin State House where the legislature looks at local ordinances that cities have developed in places like Madison and then tries to pass laws that specifically make those ordinances illegal. So we've seen this in this realm. We're seeing this now with cell towers. We're seeing it in, you know, a couple of other areas where some cities or, you know, communities with some foresight have tried to work together to put something like this in the state legislature, saying, no, stop doing that. So how is that tell us about that in this bill, and what kinds of things in the city of Madison would become illegal now?
Right. Well, it's not just the city of Madison. You know, a lot of folks, Madison has a lot of really interesting and I think, again, smart regulations, which serve as a sort of handbook for how to be a good, responsible landlord and to be a good, responsible tenant that were brought about through deliberation from an intense, you know, process through all of the committees and city council and those are being stripped away. But what I find fascinating is that the Wausau paper has now twice indicated both in its editorial and in interviews with their city council people that up in Wausau, they are upset there that this doesn't respect their ability to devise ordinances which fit the property, that fit the property in that community.
There was a time when Republicans were proponents of local control, where basically the general theory was that government is best at the lowest level possible. Has that completely gone by the wayside now?
It's still number one. I thought it was very interesting. It's apparently they have a principles page of the Republican Party here does, and that is still principle number one, is that government closest to the people is best positioned to make the rules. And that's exactly what this bill disregards and, in fact, goes completely against by taking away the ability of local municipalities to set up ordinances that are unique and address the unique circumstances of the property. And the response is that it's just so hard for a business person who and or tenants, which I think is ridiculous, if you rent in Madison or in Fitchburg, that if you go from one to the other, it's confusing. You're going to be signing or you're using probably a multiple page lease in either one. You're as a business or property owner, you're probably paying property tax to different municipalities and different counties. You have a lot of different rules. That's the cost of business. And it's a very low cost when you're talking about people who own, dozens and dozens of properties and even just a few. It's just a small cost of business that respects, the local community. And what's more local than housing?
So bring us up to date as to where we are with this bill. It's scheduled for, I believe, a final vote on June 4th in front of the Assembly, and then it moves on to the Senate. What are the prospects there?
Right. It was a third reading was objected to, so that means that it will go back for a final reading in the Assembly and then go to the Senate. So we're looking at it will be Senate Bill 179. The Senate will hold a committee hearing on it, which people can come to, register for or against. They can that hearing is not yet scheduled. You can follow the bill if you go to the government's legislature page and type in SB or Senate Bill 179. You can follow along and see when that hearing will be and make comments there, point out individual situations, particularly if you it's the Housing and Insurance Committee of the Senate, particularly if you are a a constituent of one of the senators on that committee, I would urge you to take a look at this and make your thoughts known. I think the Senate is, because of its closer divide, Democrat-Republican divide, I think they're a little bit more receptive to being deliberative and might not talk 100% past one another. But that didn't happen necessarily last year with similar legislation. So while I'm always going to be hopeful that the legislature will truly lead and represent everyone, that's certainly not going to happen unless people get out and make their voices heard.
Do you know who the senators on that committee are?
I know that the chair is, I believe, Frank Lessay.
Okay.
And it's the Committee on Housing and Insurance, I believe, for the Senate that will hear the bill.
All right. Mitch, thank you so much for joining us. Mitch is a attorney with University of Wisconsin's Neighborhood Law Project, and he joined us to talk about AB 183, the bill through the legislature that would change a lot of the tenant-landlord relationship in the state of Wisconsin. Thanks so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you.
Well, a few weeks ago, we spoke with Rebecca Kemble of the Progressive about the testimony in the federal court in Kissick v. Hipsch. That's the case where the American Civil Liberties Union is suing the state of Wisconsin in federal court for denying First Amendment rights by overzealously issuing citations to those who choose to sing or hold signs or do other innocuous things inside the state capitol. You may recall that Rebecca reported to us that state attorney Maria Lazar told federal judge William Conley that one person reciting Shakespeare in the Capitol Rotunda would require a permit. Two people discussing Shakespeare would not require a permit, but that political speech would always receive preferential treatment. Which brings us to this week's rant of the week. We decided to test attorney Lazar's rather befuddling legal theory. So here I am inside the Capitol Rotunda at 11:45 a.m. on May 9th, 2013, with a little performance.
Coriolanus, Act 1, Scene 1. We are accounted poor citizens, the patricians good. What authority surfeits on would relieve us, if they would yield us but the superfluity, while it were wholesome, we might guess that they relieved us humanely. But they think we are too dear. The leanness that afflicts us, the object of our misery, is as an inventory to particularize their abundance. Our sufferance is a gain to them. Let us revenge this with our pikes ere we become rakes. For the gods know I speak this in hunger for bread, not in thirst for revenge. What shouts are these? The other side of the city is risen. Why stay we prating here? To the Capitol!
No Capitol police officer approached me at the time, though I did see one murmuring into his walkie-talkie. To date, I have yet to receive a citation, at least for that particular oration. If Chief Irwin or anyone else from the Capitol Police happen to be listening to this broadcast, well, you have my home address. We'll be back in a little bit with an update on the iron mine in the Pinocchio Hills. Well, thanks to recent very controversial and highly publicized legislation, it has now become easier than ever before to open and operate an iron mine in Wisconsin. Since the legislation passed, many in the state have been waiting for the other shoe to drop. Well, on May 9th, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources announced that it had received an application from Gagebic Taconite LLC for preliminary exploration of an iron ore deposit in the Pinocchio Hills on the shores of Lake Superior. 7 days later, Gagebic Taconite pulled back, withdrawing its application, citing stormwater issues, and announced that it would submit a revised application shortly. DNR Mining Coordinator Ann Coakley joins us now to tell us more. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz, Ann.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now the DNR met with representatives of Gagebic Taconite on the proposed mine site on May 14th, but what happened at that field visit that caused GTAC to reverse course and withdraw their exploratory permit application?
Well, DNR staff met with them on May 14th, and we went over all 13 of the boring locations that they were proposing to do exploration borings at. And all 13 of them were in areas with no wetlands. However, some of the access roads leading to some of the borings had some wetland issues that would require either new access points or some wetland delineation and more work with their wetland consultant with our stormwater staff.
So it's curious to me that they have, at that point, withdrew their application. So basically, DNR said, okay, you know, this is fine, but you need a little more information about sort of where these wetlands are. Is this a factor of the new legislation that because of the time frames involved for a decision that it's in GTAC's interest to withdraw their application rather than simply postpone a decision on it until they can get new information?
Well, the new legislation didn't change anything regarding exploration borings.
Okay.
So the existing non-ferrous mining law that's been in place for many decades has the same timeline, 10 days. So Gogebic Taconite would have two choices. They could either leave it as is and there was no time to do the extra work and we would have to deny their application and then they would have to reapply. So instead they just withdrew the one and submitted a new one.
Have they submitted that new one yet?
Yes, they submitted it the same day that they withdrew the first one.
Okay, so now the clock is ticking on their permit application. Has DNR reviewed the revised application yet?
Yes, we have.
And what was your conclusion?
We haven't made a conclusion yet. My technical staff are still working on it, and we have until May 30th to make our decision.
Okay. Now, describe for our listeners, if you will, what exploratory borings actually mean. What's involved in that?
Well, there's different ways and methods of doing exploration borings, but in this particular case, they're proposing to do approximately 2-inch borings into the ore body and the what would become the waste rock surrounding the ore body. And they're looking at the quality of the ore body as well as the materials that they would need to remove atop and below the ore body, which would ultimately become waste rock.
So how deep,
they have a mine.
How deep does this 2-inch boring go?
They have varying depths. They proposed between around 200 to 1,400 feet.
Are there, you mentioned the sort of road access and trying to avoid wetland impacts from that, or at least minimize them. Are there other environmental impacts associated with this kind of exploratory operation?
If they avoid wetlands and waterways, the other impacts are temporary during construction when they have to improve roads or where they're actually doing the drilling, in which case they restore that area much like a construction project.
So on May 30th, the DNR will make a decision on this new revised permit that I presume includes more detailed information about where those wetlands are. What happens from there? If the DNR approves that permit on May 30th, what's the next step?
If we issue them a license for exploration, then they are free to schedule the drilling. However, I think they'll wait until the ground surface dries out a bit so that it's easier to get in drill rigs and water trucks.
And what kind of equipment will they be bringing into that area?
They're going to use a fairly small drill rig, so that won't be too difficult to get into the woods. However, they may need to bring in some water trucks, and those are larger trucks, so that's probably why they'll want to wait until the ground dries out.
What do the water trucks do?
Provide water for drilling.
Oh, okay, so it's a water-intensive operation.
I don't know if I'd say intensive, but they do need water to drive their diamond bit through the rock.
Okay. And if they complete the exploratory phase of this project, are there time limits for them to then pursue a extraction permit, or can they do that at any time?
Well, their license will be good for a year for the exploration drilling, and then it's up to the company whether they want to pursue bulk sampling, which would be the next phase of looking at a mining operation. Most companies don't do bulk sampling, but in this case where they would need to process ore, they probably will collect some bulk samples of the ore to get processing times. And if whether they do or don't do bulk sampling, then the next phase would be for them to begin their background data collection. And at some point, if they're interested in mining, they would file a pre-application notice with the Department of Natural Resources, letting us know that they will likely apply for a mining permit.
So you mentioned before that all of this activity is under law that remains unchanged with the recent legislation. At what point in the process does the new law kick in?
Well, this is the new law. I'm just saying that the new law incorporated the exploration provisions of the old law.
Okay.
Almost exactly. The bulk sampling provisions have been changed, and so have the the rest of the mining law has undergone changes.
So, and what is involved in bulk sampling? How much material would they be removing for that process?
We're not sure yet. They haven't said. We expect it to be fairly small from what we do know. However, we have not received an application for bulk sampling. What they would likely do is come in and blast an area of existing where the ore body is outcropping at the surface and collect large rocks or boulders to be taken to a pilot processing plant off-site, and probably like a 200-ton sample. But don't quote me on that because we have not received an application.
So there's no requirement in the law that the company necessarily inform you of what their future plans are in any detail. They can take it one phase at a time without providing additional information. Is that correct?
Right. We've certainly been in conversations with them at length over the spring, so we have a pretty good idea, but they're not obligated to tell us exactly what's going to be in their submittal before they send it.
Okay. And so they go through bulk sampling, perhaps, I mean, after they if they complete that, and then they make a decision sort of as to what the value and the cost of getting that ore might be. What's the phase after that? What happens next?
That's when they start collecting their baseline environmental data for writing their environmental impact report and for designing the mine.
Okay.
And
go
and
ahead.
Then if they think they're going to apply for a mining permit, they have to at least 12 months in advance file a pre-application notice with the Department of Natural Resources. It can be more than 12 months in advance, but it has to be at least 12 months in advance.
And what does that pre-application notice require?
It requires them to tell us what kind of a mine they're designing, and it requires us to tell them the kind of data that we'll need for their baseline sampling and their environmental impact report so that we know we can write a quality environmental impact statement and review their permit application.
And are there other entities that are involved in the environmental quality review? Are there federal agencies involved, or is it just the state?
Well, it depends on impacts to natural resources. So we're almost certain the Army Corps of Engineers would be involved in probably the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Aside from that, I think it's too early to say because we don't know what the other environmental impacts will be.
Now, in the run-up to the recent mining legislation, there was a lot of discussion about the role of some of the Native American tribes in that area. Do they have a role in this process?
Right. When it comes to the permit for mining, we would certainly be coordinating and consulting with the Native American tribes, in particular the Bad River Tribe. And then in addition, the Bad River Tribe, which is down gradient or downstream of what might become a mine, they have their own water quality standards that have been approved by the Environmental Protection Agency. So any mining applicant would have to meet those water quality standards at the reservation boundary.
And who makes that determination, whether or not the mine would meet the water quality standards of the Bad River Band?
EPA and the DNR.
Okay. So EPA sounds like they're going to be involved at some level in any respect, simply from that aspect alone. Is that correct?
Right, if they apply for a mining permit.
Okay. And so what? So again, they're in the process of doing exploratory borings, and how long will that process take?
If they receive a license from us, the 8 borings will likely take several weeks to complete.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Ann Coakley is the mining coordinator from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, bringing us an update on the activities of Gegebic taconite up in the Pinoki Hills. And you can find out more information by going to dnr.wi.gov, topic, mines, gegebic.html. Or you can probably search on Gegebic DNR and mines, Wisconsin. You'll probably get there, too. So thanks so much for joining us, Ann.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, and that about wraps it up for the Monday 8 o'clock buzz this week. I want to thank so much all of our guests, Mitch from the UW Neighborhood Law Clinic, Ann Coakley from the DNR. Thanks also to our all-volunteer crew, Kent Watson, our producer, Derek O'Brien, our engineer. My name is Brian Standing.